Let me just start by mentioning one thing that has just caught my attention in the last hours, which is that President-elect Obama broke his silence on the Gaza situation this evening. And I don't think broke his silence by way of criticism as regards to that silence until now. I would rather he was silent than he repeated what the current administration was saying. To me, that silence all along was interesting because it meant he wasn't simply saying, I'm with the President and the Secretary of State on this. And, of course, there was no serious ceasefire plan for him to get behind. Now, it's not like he said anything that dramatic this evening, but for me, it was a sign. And I hope 2 weeks from now, you know, we're not terribly disappointed, and I'm sure there will be disappointments along the way, but I think it was a sign of a beginnings of a move out of the dogmatic and tin-eared approach, not to mention ideologically dangerous approach, that has been taken over the last years. He simply said, I'm very concerned with the conflict taking place there. I'm monitoring the situation on a day-to-day basis. The loss of civilian life in Gaza and in Israel is a source of deep concern to me. And after Jan 20th, I'll have plenty to say about this. Not backing away from what I said during the campaign. Starting at the beginning of our administration, we're going to engage effectively and consistently in trying to resolve the conflict in the Middle East. Thus far, Obama. I wanted to give you that quote because I think there are two things in there that are tremendously useful for us as we take our message out to our audience during this very difficult time. Number one, I think he began to display the ability to find a new vocabulary. Because what I've been arguing is that one needs a new policy and a new vocabulary. And that new vocabulary has to remain staunchly pro-Israel, but be capable of convincingly demonstrating empathy for Palestinian side and for Palestinian dignity. And until you get an America that's capable of doing that, America will remain a discredited and ineffective as well as unpopular actor in the region. So first, he began to find that new vocabulary, and secondly, that commitment to resolving the conflict from the beginning. I think those are tremendously useful, the beginnings of talking points for us. And I think it allows us to say something else as well, which is very important. And that is as follows. That a Democrat Congress, no one in fact, but certainly not a Democrat Congress, should be trying to box in the new Obama administration. And I think some of the statements coming out of people sound just like Bush. Obama shouldn't sound like Bush. And America needs to not act like Bush if a very destabilized Middle East is going to be restabilized. Let me run through a few points quickly, if I may, by way of introduction. First of all, where are we with this Gaza situation right now? You're going to excuse me. I made a bit of a mistake in my timing, and you're going to be travelling with me in a car, and I apologise for that. So if there are external noises, there shouldn't be, but I apologise if there are. Where are we now in the situation in Gaza? We're at a very delicate point right now. First of all, the humanitarian situation, and it pains me when I hear Israeli spokespeople trying to speak down the humanitarian situation. I can understand why they're doing it. But the first thing to say on this is, of course, all foreign press has been barred from entering Gaza since the beginning of this conflict. What you do have, though, is very credible, reliable, international UN and Red Cross sources on the ground. And what we're hearing from them is an increasingly devastating and bleak picture as to the situation in Gaza. There are reports that Israel is considering opening humanitarian corridors. That would be a start of a kind, but obviously that falls well short of what's really needed in terms of actually getting this violence behind us. So number one, there is a humanitarian situation which I don't think we can be indifferent to. There's, of course, a humanitarian situation on the Israeli side as well. You have the communities of southern Israel still under rocket fire, and you have the schools closed, etc. But the terrible loss of life, I'm apologizing. I'm getting a call from the UN to update me what's going on there. I won't take the call, but I'll tell him I'm going to call him back. One moment.
For those that want to ask questions, write in to townhall@btvshalom.org.
I apologize. So, number one, the humanitarian situation, to finish that point. Number two, we're in a very delicate political situation. Here's how I understand the political situation we're in. The stated aim of this mission was to degrade the Hamas military capacity. I think the entire mission was unnecessary, myself. I think not enough was done to sustain the ceasefire. For 6 months, despite everything you're being told, for 6 months there was no Israeli fatality. The escalation in rocket fire only happened after November 4th as a consequence, to the best of my understanding, of a mission that Israel carried out in Gaza. But Hamas did then up the ante, and undoubtedly they went much further than... I mean, the tit-for-tat had rules to it, right? If Israel took out a Hamas activist in a certain place, it meant a certain number of rockets, mainly in open areas. If Hamas increased the rocket load, Israel would be, according to those rules, justified in doing X. Hamas went further than it had gone in the past. Israel then unleashed a dramatic escalation on the morning of Saturday, December the 27th. So, the stated aim of this is to downgrade the Hamas military capacity. Now, there's something very legitimate in a particular Israeli claim, which is that Hamas was able to extend its weapons capacity during the last period, especially things that were coming in from Egypt. On the other side, and this was an Israeli grievance throughout this period, on the other side, the Palestinian grievance, key grievance that I think was very justified, was that the blockade was not lifted on Gaza in a significant way throughout this period. I think that was particularly problematic because one of the things it did, in addition to course causing terrible human suffering throughout this period, obviously nothing compared to what we have now, but one of the things this did was it not only failed to create an incentive amongst the Palestinian public to prevent rocket fire, it almost did the opposite. Hamas is attuned to the Palestinian public. And if the Palestinian public had an interest in saying, look, we've got so much to lose, life is returning to normal, prevent rocket fire, then I think that could have had a very significant impact. I mention those two things because every ceasefire arrangement will have to address, I believe, those two components, the lifting of the blockade and more effective ways of preventing Hamas from rearming, in particular through the Egyptian border. But why this is entering a very delicate phase is the following. The argument was, one downgrades Hamas's military capacity, and then one returns to a ceasefire with Hamas, but a more effective. Again, my argument would be, that could have all been possible, absent this round of painful bloodletting, and painful bloodletting which I think will only cause terrible long-term effects to Israel's image and to the angle against Israel. But I'll close that parenthetical. I think that could have been done absent this round of bloodletting. Now we're in this stage. The argument is you downgrade their military capacity. However, the temptation is to say, and this is what's happening now, not only does one try and downgrade Hamas' military capacity, but one wants to give Hamas as much of a bloody nose as possible. So for a part of the Israeli establishment, this is about handing back control to Hamas, a Hamas that has been taught a lesson, a Hamas that has less capacity, nonetheless, a Hamas that controls Gaza. because for the last period, there has been a central governing address in Gaza. That's how there was a ceasefire in the first place. It was with Hamas. Hamas imposed law and order, etc. However, when you're doing something like this, calibrating this act is very, very difficult. So, at what point do you so diminish the, not only the Hamas military capacity, but also the Hamas political capacity, that either you as Israel become tempted to go for regime change, or Hamas says, under these circumstances, we would rather go back to being an underground fighting movement, not being involved in Gazan politics, because we no longer have the capacity to govern here. Or you even try and introduce, through the ceasefire mechanism, what I will call stealth regime change, and in so doing, you probably prevent a ceasefire from happening. Let me just outline what I mean by those things. If Hamas, first of all, the infrastructure of Hamas governance has been destroyed. Police stations, jails, government ministries, etc., etc. The personnel are still there, but depending on how long the ground goes, increasingly there will be a serious drain in Hamas personnel. And if Hamas has no political exit strategy, where it has a narrative with some dignity, it may be that Hamas decides the worst of all.
Hello, Daniel? We've lost you.
How long did you lose me for?
For about a minute.
Oh, okay. I have no idea where you lost me. I thought everything was okay. Let me just go with where I am rather than trying to be
crazy. Okay.
I would argue that the alternatives to reverting to Hamas ruling Gaza are all worse than that Hamas rule. What are those alternatives? One would be Israel taking control of Gaza. Another is that Israel hands over Gaza to the PA in Ramallah. They come back and control Gaza. But if they come back, so to speak, on Israeli tanks, their credibility will be absolutely shot, and they will look like Israeli security subcontractors. The third option of handing over to a third party, I can't see as possible. I don't think anyone will go in that. And the fourth option is you leave a Gaza with essentially no central governing address, which is the kind of Somalia scenario. So I think Israel is a very awkward place where, and I'm not saying that Hamas ruling Gaza is ideal. What I am saying is, if you want Palestinian unity, if you want a peace process, you're going to have to bring in the legitimate popular will that Hamas represents at some stage. And trying to defeat that militarily is a bad idea. So what I'm saying is, we're at a delicate phase. There is a real fear of mission creep here. Israel urgently needs a ceasefire. There are efforts afoot right now in the Security Council of the United Nations. I'm not sure if they will bear fruit yet. I would argue that Israeli politics plays massively into this. The Defense Minister Barak wants out. That one of the complicating factors is you don't need an Israeli victory narrative here. You need two Israeli victory narratives, because Barak has to have his narrative and Livni has to have her narrative, and that's complicating things dramatically. And that only an international diplomatic exit strategy is going to prevent Israel from getting sucked further and further into the Gazan quagmire. The final point I make, or maybe the penultimate point I make, is a point about the region. Right now, the Egyptian and Jordanian foreign ministers and President Abbas are at the UN. If they go away empty-handed, they will be even further isolated, discredited, delegitimized, and weakened in the region. Abbas in particular. There will be tremendous pressure on Egypt and Jordan to take stronger measures, and on Abbas too. So while Israel claims that we have this great regional coalition against extremists, it's a regional coalition we are weakening every day as these images come out of Gaza. And of course, it's a regional coalition that was anyway very weakened because Annapolis delivered so little. So the other thing to talk to mention, of course, is hopefully we can pass this immediate Gazan crisis. There'll be horrible pieces to pick up. I hope that eventually it means that one can get back into looking at the bigger picture Gaza, and people should be reminded of this, Gaza is only 6% of the territory. When we discuss a Palestinian state on the 67 lines, Gaza is only 6% of that territory. When you hear spokespeople saying, how would America feel if Canada or Mexico were lobbing missiles at us? Wouldn't we respond? Well, I imagine you would respond. And as I say, Israel has an obligation to defend its citizens. But if America had been occupying Canada and Mexico for over 40 years, they then liberated 6%, but placed a siege on that 6%. They were still occupying the other 94%. There were checkpoints and settlements everywhere in that 94%. Is it so inconceivable that there would be a Canadian or Mexican hardline armed movement that would emerge, that would be popular, and would use the 6% of so-called liberated territory, still under siege, from which to launch attacks against America? I'll leave that to your imagination. I don't want to cast aspersions on the Mexicans or the Canadians. But we have to go back to the bigger picture, and the bigger picture is, of course, getting a viable Palestinian state, getting real security and a border for Israel, and getting deoccupation.
Thanks, Daniel. Anything more? Do you want to stop here?
I want to stop because I'm going to be pressed.
Okay, how many minutes? I have a bunch of questions that have been sent in to me by activists. How much time do you have?
10 to 12 minutes.
Great. Okay, we'll use every minute. Thanks very much.
And I really apologize. And I'm cutting short.
Thank you. We accept. And we'll have you again as we usually do. A couple questions about the United States related to the Obama administration. Do you have thoughts about what you think the now president-elect, will be or should be doing? And how can he combine a role of being a friend to Israel and also return to the idea of the United States also being an honest broker?
Look, like I said, I think we need to see a change in both vocabulary and policy. Vocabulary really, really matters, and I've talked about that, but policy matters no less. And that obviously goes into the second part of the question. You have Israeli leaders who've said Israel can't survive without a two-state solution. So I think we have to try and create an ever-emerging sense of urgency around what it means to be a friend of Israel today. And I would base that on two things, essentially. And it's the inner circle and the outer circle. The inner circle is that Israel needs to get beyond the current interaction it has with the Palestinians, and you can only do that with the occupation. If we can have a full agreement with secure borders and a resolution of all the issues, that's the ideal. If it's just the territorial issue, with special arrangements in Jerusalem, but the end of claims and conflict and refugee file, if some of those things are postponed, and I don't want to elaborate on this, then that's also significant progress. So first of all, the key thing is to get beyond a more entrenched occupation, because we are not far off the day Palestinian position will not be two states, where the campaign will be an effective anti-apartheid campaign, where we'll all be in a horrible position, but beyond our own personal torment, Israel will be in an absolutely terrible position. The second is the outer circle. Driving home regional conflicts and tensions and trying to exacerbate and create a decisive resolution of the conflicts between Islamists and non-Islamists in Syria and Iran, etc., a more destabilized Middle East is a disaster for Israel. I think the most important thing would be to see a United States that is trying to calm regional tensions, that is trying to create common rules of the game, that is trying to create an inclusive regional security architecture, that is talking to more actors. I don't think I'm being naive. I'm not saying we all sit down and sing Kumbaya. What I am saying is that you create elements of power balance in the Middle East by using America, by recognizing that there are regimes that are going to be around, and working to see where we can agree, what are the common rules of the game, and how we conduct our disagreements when we disagree. The regime change, kinetic, militaristic, a deeply flawed ideological approach to the Middle East, I think has been terrible disaster from the United States and for Israel.
Thank you. We'll stick the next couple of questions to the United States. You've been in this country now 3 years doing policy work. Doing policy work, supporting advocates. What have you learned about trying to change American foreign policy, both on the policy and level of working with policymakers and also on the advocacy level?
God, that is 10 hours, not 10 minutes.
Yeah. And I think I'd just add another question somebody threw in. How would you present a narrative to the constituents right here in the United States on this issue that will keep us motivated and growing during this next period of time, which could be a very challenging and also interesting period of time?
Yeah. Look, on the first part of the question, there is a very, very entrenched knee-jerk reflexive rather than reflective approach to Israel here, which doesn't do us any favors, doesn't do Israel any favors, but it's very real and it's difficult to overcome. But there are new ways of educating people that are available today on the internet, in the blogosphere, and by, still being able to do organizing, which is also some of the organizing that you did. In terms of, I just can't do justice to that question in a short period of time, so let me move on to the next one in terms of the narrative. I don't know what people think. My own sense is to wrap this up in the American flag as much as possible. That's my own take on it. I mean, I think with a Jewish audience, certainly to lean more on the urgency of this for Israel. And I honestly do not think it is melodramatic to say that the policies that the right wing advocate here regarding Israel, and too often that includes a large chunk of the Democrat Party, the policies that are advocated is driving Israel towards national suicide. Like I say, it sounds melodramatic. I don't think it is in the current circumstances. When you're beyond the Jewish audience, and also with a Jewish audience, there's a real American interest here. My argument is, first of all, that the American credibility, American security, push back against the real extremists, the Salafi jihadists, the ability to restore America's capacity to work with allies, even to create conducive conditions for the withdrawal from Iraq, all of those are greatly affected by the iconic litmus test issue for the Middle East. And we've seen again these last 11 days that the iconic litmus test issue for the Middle East is the Palestinian issue. Now, for me, and it's very important to clarify, that does not mean that the Israeli-American relationship per se undermines U.S. interest. It is the contours of that relationship in the absence of a resolution to the core Palestinian grievance. And when I talk about the core Palestinian grievance, I'm not talking about religion, so I'm not talking about 48, I'm not talking about the creation of Israel. I'm talking about the continued occupation and the inability to give Palestinians statehood with viability and dignity. So I'm not arguing against the Israeli-American relationship. I'm saying that for both sides, it needs to be brought to far more constructive terrain that serves both interests. I go much further, but let me limit it to that for now.
Great. You should know, Daniel, there are 240 callers on the line, so you are one of our most popular speakers.
You're making me feel bad.
No, we'll just have you back.
We're banned.
Do we have time for a couple more?
Go on.
How would you talk about, or how do you construe the developing so-called debate between Eric Yaffe from the Reform Movement and his comments about J Street, and what does that reflect to you about what's happening right now within the Jewish world?
Look,
in this country?
I obviously think Jay Street and Britt Sedek and others are in the right place on this issue. And I think it's a shame that that Eric Joffe chose to take the stand he did. I think he should also hear that from members of the reform movement and the reform community. I think it's very, very important. You have a rabbinical council. I'm not calling for a revolution against Eric Joffe. I respect Eric Joffe. I think he called this one very, very wrong. I think if at a time like this is the time to test. It's very, you know, it's very easy that for the reform movement to talk about Darfur or to talk about inner city poverty. This is the place you're tested. The place you're tested is when you have to look deep inside yourself and find that capacity to maintain your moral judgment and be constructively critical and maintain your constructive thinking faculties. And like I say, it's not a personal attack on Rabbi Yossi, but I think he got this terribly wrong. I personally cannot watch these scenes and condone them. I think we don't do Israel any favors by suggesting they can be condoned. I think Israel is doing terrible damage to itself. That doesn't mean I can condone rocket fire on Israel either. But to not be able to find a position, as we have done in Britain, in J Street, that is supportive of Israel's basic rights, but that also adheres to a basic set of values and a basic vision of what will actually bring security and peace to Israel, to not be able to talk about the humanitarian situation, to not be able to talk about the blockade, to not be able to look at the bigger picture, to imagine that this began yesterday with the first rocket fire and there's not a broader context to it, I think is a little bit insulting for the intelligence. I'm saddened that he felt he had to find solace in the warmth of an establishment consensus, that if the establishment here were so right and had done so much to Israel's security, why are we still in the place we are? I think Israel needs the help of the American jury, but not that place. Let's have the last question. Otherwise, I'm going to
Do you want that to be the last thing?
I'll do one more.
Okay. There were several questions about what your view is about the upcoming Israeli elections, how this crisis right now plays into that or doesn't, and what do you think are possibilities?
That, thankfully, is the easiest and shortest one. It is so impossible to determine that when we're in the heat of a crisis. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's helping Barak. I think Libni is looking for her victory narrative. Who knows where this will be in 10 days? I think Barak knows he's better off if he gets out now. But personally, I don't see that much hope in Livni or Barak. I hate to say that to people. I'm very worried about the growth of the far right, but the far right has splintered in this election. I'm encouraged by developments on the left, but in this kind of circumstances, the merits movement, there's no debate. There's no debate about any other issue. There's no space for an election. These terrible circumstances in which to go into an election in every way. But it would really be foolhardy to predict now, given that we're very uncertain what will be the ultimate backdrop against which this election is fought. I'm very appreciative of everyone who's got onto the call. I'm terribly apologetic that I have to leave the call now, and I'm very grateful for you, Diane.
Thank you, and we'll have you back. And thanks, Daniel. And this. As he leaves, I just want people to know that this talk was being recorded and will be on our website. Tomorrow morning, you'll be getting another action alert about calling Congress. We've had tremendous success, and the call with articles with Congress and the action alert is now being coordinated with J Street. So the two organizations will be doing it together. We've already had quite a bit of success in numbers of calls that have gone in to various Congress people and senators. And we want to increase the number of calls, and we've gotten word in Congress that people are quite impressed with the activity that they've never seen before. Again, thank you to everybody. We hope also that you'll contribute both time and, if you can, financially to Britt Sedek Fisher Lom, to go onto our website, www. www.btvshalom.org. And as sad as this situation is, I see today a more powerful pro-Israel, pro-peace movement in the United States than ever before. And I appreciate the particular role that Brit Zedek has played increasingly with our allies throughout the United States. And probably there will be more and more people joining us in the next period.